Or perhaps you'll find a zombie takeout, if you're lucky.
What's up? Welcome to episode 177 of Zombie Takeout.
Zombie Takeout.
The B-Movie and Cult Movie Podcast. I'm Uncle John.
And I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, got a little bit of news. First story from TheWrap.com. Toronto A24 closes deal for Scarlett Johansson's sci-fi thriller Under the Skin. A24 has closed a deal for its second high-profile Toronto Film Fest pickup. This time, Scarlett Johansson's sci-fi hitchhiker thriller Under the Skin. According to a person with knowledge of the deal. Jonathan Glazer, director of Sexy Beast, directed the movie that was a decade in the making.
Wow.
Johansson plays an alien living among humans who preys on men in the Scottish Highlands where it was filmed.
There can be only one of those movies, from what I understand.
The Highlander reference, of course. But what I'm thinking is, okay, decade in the making, and the plot sounds like a reboot of Species.
Yes.
What happened to Scarlett Johansson?
Either Species or My Stepmother's an Alien. I don't know.
Preying on men kind of leans more toward the Species side.
Okay. Preying. Yeah.
I haven't seen that movie in ages. Stepmother's an Alien, I mean.
Well, yeah, why would you?
Well, yeah.
Why would anybody see that movie in
kinda
decades?
Like this. Anyway, this will be interesting. Hopefully it's better than Species. Otherwise, Scarlett Johansson really needs to find a better manager.
Yeah.
Really needs better representation.
Only if they nailed Ben Kingsley in for it.
Oh, yeah. And Alfred Molina.
Yes.
He hasn't slummed in a while.
Just reprise their roles. Wait a minute. This is the wrong movie.
And our next story from BeyondHollywood.com, and thanks to Richard Hawes for posting this on our Facebook page. Showgirls 2 is finally getting released, so here's a new trailer. Director Rena Riffle's Showgirls 2, the film nobody wanted, is finally getting a proper release in North America. Judging from the trailer, Showgirls 2, Pennies from Heaven, could be on par with the likes of The Room and Birdemic. Its appeal may not be broad, but I could see this one getting popular for all the wrong reasons. Glenn Plummer also reprises his role. Here's the plot. Vegas stripper Penny Slot, that name still...
It does. That does not get old.
Sets out on an adventure to become the next dancer on a popular television show. With stars in her eyes, she tries to find the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but instead finds drama, danger, and snuff movies in a town much more wicked than Sin City. Penny's longtime boyfriend, Glenn Plummer's character from the original movie, warns her that she needs formal training if she wants to be taken seriously as a dancer. So Penny sets out to learn ballet, but must pay the price to make it to the top. There are sacrifices to be made at every imaginable level, and it all comes down to how bad do you want it. Showgirls 2 will hit DVD and VOD on September 17th. I watched the trailer. The production values, acting, and dialogue look like porn. Straight
wow.
up look like porn.
And so there's no theatrical release for this.
It's Showgirls 2.
Yeah, but come on. I mean, from what I remember, when we did the movie and we talked about the sequel, weren't they talking about it being pretty much a goof, straight up?
It could be a parody, I'm hoping. I'm actually kind of curious to see it, even though I vowed never to watch the original again. This could be hilarious, whether intentionally or not. What I find interesting, well, first, the plot is basically what you called. You said she was going to try to get into mainstream movies. It's actually a TV show.
Yeah.
And she ends up, and this is the odd part, snuff films?
Yes.
Clearly she's not starring in them.
Right.
I suspect they said snuff, but they meant porn. Some people confuse the two.
I don't know. I don't think they would confuse the two.
I just, that's really a, because, the reason you would come to that conclusion about, being porn is that's the logical thing. That's the logical, next level of that story. Stuff is a really big jump.
Is that like an episode of the IT Crowd or something where he gets involved in well, that wasn't for a film, it was a cannibal.
Right. That snuff film aspect just kind of confuses me, and I think that's mostly what I'm curious to see about it. I just want to see where they take that.
Where does that go? Yeah.
That's surprising if that's what they actually intended. Anyway, on to this week's movie, and it is from 2009, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. By the way, our longest title to date, I checked. I actually counted.
Really?
In terms of syllables, this is the longest title we've done so far, by one.
Wow. What was the what before this?
Don't recall, but it was off by one. There was one we did that was one syllable shorter. I don't recall it offhand.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians?
No, it was something more recent and surprising. I don't recall again.
Ishtar? No.
Yes. Anyway. Of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by creepy unintentional foreshadowing, because you just can't make that shit up.
Oh, yeah. Also brought to you by Ideal Homes, what every carny folk aspires to. All right. So we have the traveling carny folk, freak show, sideshow, call
More of a
them what you
sideshow.
will. Yeah. Although sideshow technically would have to have a main show.
Circus, yeah, true.
These guys just traveled throughout the back alleys of London and tried to pick up drunks. They weren't very clear as to what they were picking them up for. It seemed like at first they were just picking them up for their cash, but it turns out that it is to collect. Well, actually, it isn't really to collect their soul. It's to
Win their soul.
free, win or free their soul.
Yeah, in the case of the doctor, yes.
Right. But of course, there is. Can we just start calling the devil Tom Waits?
Yeah, okay.
Instead of referring to him as the devil, I mean,
Mr. Nick, I think the character's name was.
even outside of this movie in quote unquote real life, just refer to him as Tom Waits. The
It was kind of
devil.
perfect casting.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think he's played the devil before too. I
Think
think
so too, yeah.
that was this is not his first spin as the devil. But the devil is or Tom Waits is not far behind, and he is of course competing for souls from the good doctor, and they wind he winds up luring the doctor in with a series of bets over millennia, I believe,
A
right?
1,000 years.
1,000 years, over 1 millennium, and he lures him into certain bets and stuff he just really can't cover, not his soul, but of course the souls of people he cares for, and I could almost say hilarity ensues at this point, but there is one other
Yes.
part of the plot to get to. They pick up a well, a hanging man.
Literally.
I'd say a drifter, but he was literally hanging under a bridge. And at first you believe, well, how could he survive this? I mean, if you fell off a bridge with the noose around your neck, how could you possibly survive that? But then you realize there is some magic at work there
That
to
I
keep him
didn't
alive.
connect until the end of the movie.
Yeah.
I didn't realize why he was doing that until that last scene where it becomes a factor.
Right,
And
right.
then
It
it all clicked.
becomes a serious plot point at the end. And honestly, we could, well, he has a past. He cannot remember his past. And he's very much a fallen soul already.
And he gets into a love triangle with Spider-Man and the vampire chick from The Moth Diaries.
Yes. And who is 16, which is one of the most disturbing parts of this movie, I think.
Yeah.
I don't want to go to jail.
Fortunately, I think she was probably older when in reality.
Of course. But if you just keep thinking of, they had to make her 16.
Certainly hope so, given the image search I did during a break from the movie.
But yeah, he is obviously a fallen soul, this hanging man, and the more his past comes back to him, the worse he gets, and they try to he has to settle his bets, and hilarity ensues.
Now, the whole thing is predicated, I don't know if you really got into this, the sideshow has this mirror leads to, and they weren't really clear if it was the person's imagination or Parnassus's imagination.
I believe it was the person's imagination because that was the thing. They had a rule that they could not let more than one person through, which of course they violate repeatedly.
Yes, and it gets very gets very Terry Gilliam, I'll put it that way.
It's the strongest imagination that is dominant that you see.
But the prop was interesting because it's this obvious cheesy prop mirror with these two pieces of tinfoil in a frame.
Mm-hmm. Well, they spend all this time before they actually go into the Imaginarium itself. They, you know, mucking about the entire sideshow. The drunk is kind of trashing the place.
Right.
In the very beginning, and you just see there's nothing there, and then he just goes through this mirror, and then, whoa.
I was just kind of expecting a better effect. I mean, I understand the point, because if it was an effect, it would have really drawn attention.
Right.
If it was this mystical mirror that people just disappeared into, it would have been odd. Whereas this obvious prop, nobody's going to blink an eye at it.
Right. So everything looks like shit. And this, but if you go through this one mirror, you're into
a
literally
world.
Another world, yeah.
And of course, Gilliam is known for his originality in his images, and you know, just being completely bizarre and brilliant in that respect. Yet he kind of went to a very popular well on this one.
Oh yeah,
I think it might be the first time we go into the Imaginarium. There are space jellyfish. Kind of overused. I've seen space jellyfish a number of times because jellyfish look really freaky, and if you put them in space, it kind of, you know, gets interesting. But many people have done this. I was a little disappointed by that.
I would say the biggest was Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Okay, yes.
That would probably be the biggest example.
Hmm.
Where, you know, Troy felt anger and frustration.
Yes, I remember now, yeah.
Oh, my God.
But that's really my only criticism from a visual standpoint.
Yeah, I would say even that.
The rest of it is kind of brilliant.
Even that visual effect that he used was so fucking...
Oh, it looked great.
Yes.
It's just kind of an overused idea. But he pulled it off beautifully, of course.
And it was pretty much a throwaway effect, which there are lots of them in this movie.
Yeah.
He doesn't stay with much for long, even the really brilliant stuff.
And I think that gets to my real criticism of the movie. It's very unfocused. He kind of had a lot of ideas that he threw in and didn't really have an overarching idea.
Well, he does have, I mean, the overarching idea, of course, is the redemption of a soul.
Yeah, but it doesn't really feel like it has a point at the end. And going along, there's no real through line. There was nothing that really pulled me along in the movie. It was really just a collection of scenes and cool images to me.
Well, right. And I was thinking, listening today to last week's episode, we talked about the one filmmaker who's retiring.
Miyazaki.
How very much the movie is just like that.
Yeah, in a sense, it's. I was actually, when I was saying that about the lack of a plot, I was kind of thinking it is kind of Miyazaki-ish.
It is.
In the sense that what I said about Miyazaki is his plots aren't very original, but his visuals are stunning.
Right. I mean, the
Gillian is
redemption
always
of.
is known for stunning visuals, but his plots are usually a lot more coherent than this.
Are they?
There's at least a through line. There's they hold your attention.
Because, I mean, wasn't Brazil quite out there? Time Bandits was definitely.
Time Bandits was Gilliam. I forgot. Okay. That was another weak spot.
But Brazil was out there.
But Brazil held my attention.
Brazil was insane.
I was fighting to pay attention to this movie.
Really?
Yeah. In terms of the story, it just didn't hold me. I suspect a lot of that was casting.
I didn't take that many notes because I was just completely mesmerized by this thing. I couldn't really put it, tear myself away from it.
I think my problem had a lot to do with casting because it relies very heavily on Lily Cole.
I think
and
casting
too heavily
because
she can't act.
Casting is the weakest point of the movie. She was definitely better than The Moth Diaries.
Yes,
which,
yes.
But that still, of course, isn't saying much. But she at least was a professional actress in this movie, where Moth Diaries.
Fair enough, fair enough.
It seemed like she was just a model. Mm-hmm. Vern Troyer started strong, I felt. But then by the middle, he went back into his own kind of presentational thing where it's.
And it's the pissed off little person act. And I have in my notes, it's some of the best acting I've ever seen from him, which isn't really saying much when you're talking about Vern Troyer.
Right.
But he does start strong. It is a legitimately decent performance. And then he becomes the caricature that he always is.
Right. And it's not even the pissed off little guy. He has a cadence that he falls into. And he wasn't in that cadence at the very beginning. And of course, I mean, I won't reenact it or anything, but as soon as you hear it,
I know what you mean about his cadence. You're right.
Yes, he falls into that Vernon Troyer cadence in the middle, but it was kind of disappointing because I was like, "Oh man, he started out good, and I would think of the story we would have had if like fucking Vernon Troyer did have put in a solid performance from getting the end.
Right?
How amazing that would have been.
Put bone in a brain.
Yeah, it would have.
Now there's an interesting character moment with the daughter, Valentina, Lily Cole's character.
Yeah.
She dreams of having a normal life. She has these magazines that are basically Holmes magazines. And she just kind of looks at these, you know, this family sitting on a couch and dreams that that was her life. Which I thought was interesting, given that she was born into this traveling sideshow.
Right. You always want what's on the other side, you know? How many kids dream of running off for the circus when they're, you know, young? Well, I don't even know if kids do that anymore.
Before we get to the elephant in the room, I do have one little nitpick, and this is a little silly, but it gets into Parnassus's, and I hate saying his name possessive like that because it just sounds weird. It gets into the backstory on Dr. Parnassus. Turns out he was a monk 1,000 years ago who made this deal with the devil. It kind of gave the impression that he was a Buddhist monk. It was very, you know, Eastern. A white British guy. A Buddhist monk 1,000 years ago.
I don't know where they were at, actually. It was a very strange, you know, kind of vortexy looking place. But yeah, you're right. There were a lot of Asian themes to it.
Gilliam dressed it up to be nonspecific, but it was very distinctly Asian, including the set and their sanctuary built into this snowy mountain. And I think there was a Buddha statue, and it just didn't look right when you have the you know, Christopher Plummer as a monk there. Now, the elephant in the room, I suppose we need to get it to.
Yeah.
This was Heath Ledger's last film. He died a third of the way into making it.
Was it really only a third of the way in?
Yes, that's what I read.
I mean, he was in it for so much.
Well, they film out of sequence, of course, so.
Yeah.
I was surprised to see him pop up because his role is taken over by
a team of actors.
Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell at different times. And it was a brilliant device that they used to pull that off.
And it made perfect sense.
Yeah. Every time he went to the Imaginarium, he had a different face.
Yeah.
But his initial introduction, which you talked about in the summary, The Hanging Man.
Yeah.
A little creepy in hindsight.
Oh my god, yeah.
Very creepy.
Yeah.
I actually had to check to make sure that wasn't how he died. No, he overdosed
It was
on
OD, yeah.
prescription, yeah, pills.
You were thinking he carradined her.
Yeah, or Hutchinson's.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because didn't they go around the same time, actually?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah.
But also, one of Johnny Depp's early lines is, nothing's permanent, even death.
Wow.
You know, the guy who took over the role has that line.
Well, and that at that point, they knew he was gone.
Yeah. And Gilliam has said that he didn't change anything about the script other than the casting after Ledger died. I think maybe that line should have been removed. And I guess you can't really work around the main storyline of him being the hanging man. He gets hanged 3 times in the movie, counting the introduction 3 times.
Right. It was so weird how interchangeable Ledger, Depp, and Law were. I mean, when Depp came in, I had to look a couple times to realize that it was no longer Ledger.
I caught it, but I was surprised how much of a resemblance there is.
Well, yeah, especially those two. Those two is damn creepy.
The one that really I had to look closely was Law, Jude Law, when he took over the role. That wasn't Depp, because those two with the facial hair looked frighteningly similar.
Yeah, Law was a little easier to spot for me. That smile and everything, of course, of his.
And of course, Colin Farrell looks nothing like either.
Yes, Colin Farrell is just he's the sore thumb of the bunch.
Well, that's when you're in. Tony, that's the character's name. In his imagination, in his fantasy, he looks like Colin Farrell.
Right. And it's a shame because of the team that are playing this character.
Yeah, he's the weak link by far.
Easily the worst.
Heath Ledger was unfortunately underrated as an actor up until Batman.
He's the biggest sore spot I have with this movie, Farrell.
Depp is a brilliant actor, has been made very clear. Even Law has done some brilliant work, but Farrell never really found his stride.
Yeah, it's a shame they couldn't, get the money for DiCaprio.
That would have been very interesting, yes.
Yeah, because at first that's who I thought that was, and then once he spoke, I was like, oh, that's not Leonardo DiCaprio. Who the fuck is that again?
At first, I thought somebody else looped the voice because it didn't quite sound like Farrell. I'm used to his Irish accent, but
yeah.
After a few lines, I realized that was him. Speaking of looping, there was a little flub that they should have looped out.
What's that?
Shortly after they rescue Tony, Valentina and Anton, Garfield's character, rescue him from hanging, and they're trying to revive him. And they carry him to this trunk at the back of the sideshow, of the wagon, I guess it is.
Yeah.
And you clearly hear Lily Cole say, "Andrew, put him in the trunk."
Oh, yeah?
The character's name is Anton. The actor's name is Andrew.
They didn't hire her for her screen-reading ability, did they?
I had to listen to it like 3 times to make sure I was right. She says Andrew. Thing is, okay, I don't blame her for this. It's an easy mistake to make. It was a night shoot. There was rain going on, She just blanked for a second. That's fine. And I even understand not reshooting it, given the conditions. Can't you just bring her in to do ADR for that one word? You can't really see her face. There wouldn't have been a mismatch with the lip sync. Why not just have her record the right name and fix the mistake? It was very sloppy on Gilliam's part, I think, to leave that mistake in there.
I missed it, but damn.
Also, Plummer was actually one of the few actors in the movie I didn't associate with another role.
Which is odd, because he's played everything.
Yeah, he's obviously by far the most experienced of the lot, but I associate Lily Cole with Moth Diaries, Andrew Garfield with Spider-Man, Heath Ledger with mostly A Knight's Tale.
Yeah, same here, Knight's Tale, so really. Joker. Well, the Joker, you've got the makeup, and it's just not the not
And
the
that
same.
Was the first thing I saw him in, was A Knight's Tale, and I'm one of the few, we've talked about this, we're among the few who like that movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, what's not to like about it?
But it was just kind of odd. The one actor who had by far the most experience was the one I don't have any baggage with. Obviously, Vern Troyer's Mini-Me. I left him out.
Christopher Plummer, I'm thinking Star Trek: The Undiscovered Country.
Okay, yeah.
But then again, he had like all the Klingon makeup on for
I
that.
never would have thought of that offhand, but you say it, and I picture him in
Yeah.
makeup, which is odd because I've only seen the movie once in theaters.
Wow. But reading the Shakespeare and everything, yeah. What a great fucking scene that
We should
was.
probably revisit it. It's probably a lot better.
Yeah.
So,
Oh, definitely.
I also have to give Andrew Garfield a lot of credit. The man is very good with accents.
Yeah, I thought he was solid in this.
Well, great British accent. When I first saw the movie, I saw the first half of this couple, maybe a year or two ago. I didn't know who he was. I assumed he was British. He also did a New York accent in Spider-Man. Completely believable. A Spider-Man with a New York accent. Best part of the movie. Or one of the best parts.
I mean, really, after seeing this, it was like, well, why couldn't they have gotten him for the next Doctor, you know?
Well, I think it has to be British, but
Yeah.
it's kind of a thing.
I guess so.
Oh, okay, one more minor little nitpick. And I think this could be easily explained. Where does the body go when the mind goes into the Imaginarium?
Body goes into the Imaginarium. The entire person goes into the Imaginarium.
They physically go into their own brain?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fantasy movie. I'm not really nitpicking it. I just thought that was kind of odd that the body disappears when they go into the mind.
Body disappears. It's just like Malkovich.
Oh, okay, yeah, fair enough. I really didn't complain about Malkovich. I can't really complain about that. Bit of trivia. The film contains various references to the classic staging of Samuel Beckett's play Waiting for Godot, including Tom Waits' black suit and bowler hat, and Jude Law dragging a rope noose around his neck, as does Lucky in the play. It's been ages since I've read Waiting for Godot, and I don't know that I've ever seen it produced, so I
Me neither. I would
really
love
pick
to
up
see a
on this.
production of that.
Yeah. Also, Ledger improvised half of his comedic dialogue.
No kidding.
Oh, and speaking of the other Tonys, Johnny Depp, Colin Farrell, and Jude Law gave all of their income received from the movie to Ledger's daughter.
Wow.
That was very nice.
Yeah.
Okay, now there was a point in the movie that was incredibly Python. I think it was probably the most Python thing that Gilliam has done since leaving the Pythons.
Probably since Time Bandits. There are a lot of Python things
Yeah,
in the Time
fair enough. But
Bandits.
this is, if we're talking about the same scene, this could
But
have been.
this was Python without any of the Python cast in it, so it
Oh,
was just
yeah.
kind of
Well,
amazingly Python.
a specific scene I'm talking about, not the movie in general.
Oh yeah.
The cops. Okay,
The
good, we're on the same page there.
cops. Of course. It was almost like watching a Gilliam animation with the big, the cop head coming out of the sand, or a plumber with the cops, helmet on.
Some loan sharks from Tony's past end up chasing him into the Imaginarium. And as they're about to catch him and hang him, this giant metal cop head comes out of the what looked like a golf course. And these very burly men in drag in female cop uniforms start doing this musical number.
Yeah, and usually musical numbers would cost a
Not this time, no.
but Gilliam knows how to do it,
Yeah.
doesn't he? Because I was thinking back to Fisher King. Oh, well, I guess they didn't really have musical numbers in Fisher King, but he did have people breaking into song that were fucking clever as hell, though. I mean, the
Right.
New York in June and the and oh, what was the guy sing the guy in drag singing Telegram? In the middle of fucking.
I need to rewatch that movie.
I forget what it was, but it was fucking crazy. It was like the little guy from Burt Reynolds' show in drag. But this movie, The Cops.
The cops. It felt like a Python sketch.
Oh my god, yeah, it
This is
was.
something they would have done in like Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
They would have brought all these random guys in to do this song and dance routine. Probably my favorite part of the movie.
It was insane. It was such a treat because you got to watch Terry Gilliam do a Python animation with these effects.
In live action.
Yes, and live action combined. So it wasn't no longer cheesy painting cutouts and whatever, flapping together. No, this was insane CGI and other effects
I don't even
put in
know if
there.
that was CGI. I mean, it probably was, but it looked pretty real.
Well, that's the thing with him. He used so many visual effects at the same time. Your head can't help but spin.
Now, we're talking about the best part. Now, I think we should balance it with the point where I think we would both agree it kind of went off the rails. The Colin Farrell scene.
Well, yeah.
From there up through when the devil wins, effectively, the dancing scene with Lily Hall, that whole maybe 10 minutes there, completely off the rails. It was just, and I normally like self-indulgent, but he got too self-indulgent.
Oh, you didn't like the shattered glass effect?
No. A bad special effect in a Terry Gilliam movie is just disappointing too.
I don't know. It kind of all went together, I thought. The entire thing was shattered, and he just kind of kept playing with that visual effect all over the place. I don't know. It was kind of neat.
I think it maybe just went too quickly for me, and it just seemed like it was at the cost of the story, in a sense.
I think if he had held on to it for too long, though, then it would have gotten dull, you know?
See, to me it did.
It was something you had to move through quickly. The whole dance, the whole shattering, the whole just absolute chaos of what was going on at the time. I think it could have held together if he had a more capable actor playing essentially his lead at that point. He gave the keys to to drive to a guy who just wasn't up for the task.
And I think that speaks to the big issue with the movie. I mean, I've just talked about how, the plot meanders, and I think even that I would have been able to deal with, except that scene he gives the keys to Colin Farrell. And for a lot of the movie, it relies too heavily on Valentina, the daughter, Lily Cole. He gave her more than she could handle as an actor.
She's, definitely a part of the bigger triangle, which isn't really necessarily Anton,
No,
but of
it's
course,
the doctor, the devil, and her, yeah.
the doctor.
And she just wasn't up for the job, and I think it hurt the movie to a large extent. That and when Vern Troyer is your conscience, it doesn't quite work. Because effectively, his character was the conscience.
I think all of those things would have worked, but Colin Farrell, no. Colin Farrell could have handled a smaller, one of the earlier portions, maybe. Maybe the portion that Jude Law was in. But I think that was too important of a part. I think Jude Law would have been perfect for that
Absolutely.
last part. And I think it really would have held it all together in the end. Because at that point, he is the lead actor. I mean,
Up until the all but the last scene.
Plummer has to kind of take a back seat to his story because that's the final telling of his story where it all comes together and this is why he's here and this is why the devil's interested in him and why he's good at what he's done there and all the talents. But the problem is it's Colin, he Colin Farrell's the one that has to tell this story, and he just isn't believable. He's just the guy that's, he could have been, the president of the galaxy in
They thought,
Hitchhiker's
yeah,
Guide,
that would have
yeah,
been great casting.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy,
Nothing against
but,
Sam Rockwell, he was great in the role,
right,
but
nothing
Farrell would
against
have
him at
pulled it
all.
off.
But Farrell could have pulled it off without acting, because that is Colin Farrell. But here, I mean, the story is still good. The story is still interesting because of what he did, because I mean,
yeah,
he hid what he did with the lie.
Right.
You know, I told this terrible thing, but then when the actual secret comes out of what he did, it's, oh, holy shit.
Right.
And I think if we had a more capable actor, that whole last sequence would have worked so much better.
That's a distinct possibility, yeah. It may not have been Gilliam's fault. It may just, the glue wasn't there to hold it together, so it kind of...
Gilliam is cursed as a director, I think.
Yeah.
We had to mention this before.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But I mean, he had, I think he had the workings of a masterpiece here and then lost, you know, like had one figure of the masterpiece just whited out.
I think there were a few missing pieces, but or flawed pieces. But I also read that this, speaking of Gilliam being cursed, was made right after the Man of La Mancha film that he did, Don Quixote.
Yeah.
What was the name? Do you remember the name offhand? I don't recall.
I forget it. It wasn't just Don Quixote?
Possibly, yeah. There was also a documentary. That's what I'm thinking. Searching for La Mancha or something. There was a documentary about the failure of his attempt to make Don Quixote. I think it had happened shortly after that whole thing fell through.
Wow, really? I thought that happened after this.
I don't remember exactly, but that failure had a big influence on this film. And I think a lot of his anger kind of showed through. Because that almost ended his career.
Well, yeah.
He almost retired after that mess.
And I think you could blame him, you know, he had to go through all of that and, you know, not come out with the film.
And I think a lot of that showed in the character of Dr. Parnassus. Because he is kind of a flawed god, in a sense.
Right, right.
Very much so. And very angry god.
And then the times have changed around him and people aren't interested in his stories anymore.
Right.
That you know, is what Gilliam's pretty much been living through. I mean, he's still making films, but, you know, he hasn't really drawn any attention in a long time now.
And actually, I forgot to mention part of the doctor's backstory. When he was a monk, his order were tasked with continually telling the story of the world so that the world could continue. And that really says a lot about Gilliam's mindset when he made the film. You know, the doctor is a storyteller. And a failed storyteller, effectively.
Yeah.
And okay, the ending. I think that's really what we're up to. Nothing really as much to say except very tacked on. Because Parnassus falls apart, you know, has that final admission, basically. And, you know, pays his penance. And suddenly he's transported back to the moment he met his wife. And kind of given a second chance. Or what we think is the moment he met his wife initially.
I was going to say, I didn't think that was the moment he met his wife.
Well, Vetrich, she had dark hair.
Yeah.
That's why he chased after her. Okay, he does go into the future.
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah.
Pretty much it's him at the present.
Right. And it just seemed very tacked on.
Well, he, you know, searched the world for her. And it was, you know... Yeah, you have to end with either he finds her or he doesn't.
True. See, I missed the whole searching side of it.
Yeah.
I didn't pick up on that. Because he has this moment where he falls apart in, effectively, the desert in the Imaginarium. And suddenly he wakes up begging on the street corner in real life.
Well, because it was the trick the devil had played on him again. You know, he... In order for her not to lose her soul, he had to give up everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had to give up
Tony,
who was keeping the show alive, and, you know, Anton, he had to push him away.
He didn't push Anton away. She dropped, he chose to.
Oh, that's right.
Sacrifice himself to save her. He fell off a ledge. She was holding on to him to save him, and she was not going to be able to lift him, so he just let go and sacrificed himself.
He had to destroy everything he had in order to save her in the end.
Right.
Like, that was kind of the point of his final bet with him, with the doctor.
That, yeah. That didn't really read for me. I mean, I in hindsight, yeah, now as you mentioned, I can see it. But when you see him in the present, it just looked a lot like the earlier scene when he met his wife.
And that was at an earlier time period. I'm not
Yeah, of
sure.
course.
I guess that would have been, I'm
Well,
trying to think of
16 years earlier.
more than that,
Or a little more,
because
but not much.
she was old by the time
That's
she
right.
had
She was
her.
60 when she had her.
So this was probably
Like,
like,
for.
that was like the 1940s, I think it was, or
Probably,
something to that
yeah.
effect. And then this was back in the present. And he, you know, finally finds her, but,
And it was exceedingly happy, I think. I mean, yeah, you're right. He kind of has to find her or not, and a happy
well,
ending is one thing, but a too perfect ending is quite another.
it wasn't all that perfect because he couldn't actually.
Well, yeah, true. There was the bittersweet aspect, and we brought back Vern Troyer to be the conscience again, which.
Well, but he was putting the street act back together in the end,
Yeah.
and probably, you know, going to build it up to something else again.
It just seemed tacked on. I mean, I get it now. It just seems, I don't know, tacked on. I didn't care for it. I'm pretty much done with my notes.
Yeah.
No sequels or remakes. Way too soon for a remake, of
How
course.
could you? How could you remake this?
Yeah, well, I think this goes for any Gilliam movie. You know, remakes are kind of pointless.
I mean, thinking of any Gilliam movie, maybe Brazil or something would be interesting to see a remake of it these days
I can't think of who, though.
with you know like government agencies and
Yeah,
everything.
the story would be interesting, but who else could remake a Gilliam movie?
Well, right. You'd have to have a crazy
Yeah, nobody. There's no one like Gilliam.
Guillermo del Toro, who's
Yeah.
pretty much just a Gilliam disciple, really, in the end.
Right, true. But anyway, way too soon. It's only been a few years.
Right.
And there's really no room for a sequel. So, on to brains.
Yeah, I think we're on to brains.
I struggled with this one because it doesn't feel right to not put a Terry Gilliam movie on the recommendations list. It feels just, I feel guilty not doing it, but I really can't go higher than 3.5.
Oh, wow. That's a shame this won't be recommended because I wholeheartedly recommend this. I'd probably watch this again, right now with no problem. It's probably his most personal, I think, that I've seen at least. There's a couple of Gilliam movies I have not seen yet, like Tideland and Brothers Grimm.
Don't bother with Brothers Grimm. That is by far his worst movie.
It's on my Netflix, so I still want to see it.
Completionist thing, I get that, yeah.
Yeah. But the effects will have you from beginning to
Oh,
end, let
visually, it's amazing, yeah.
alone visually. It's magnificent. Some of the performances, though spotty, there are some that are just phenomenal,
Oh,
like
yeah.
Plummer, that
And
make
Andrew
up for
Garfield.
it. Yeah, Plummer and Ledger too,
Yeah.
really. He would have been a killer Alex if he
Oh,
had the
wow,
chance, given the
yeah.
chance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just seeing him with that the Harlequin mask. I think with some of the rough patches though, I can't go all the way to 5, so I'm gonna go 4.5.
Okay. And what have we learned?
That Colin Farrell just doesn't belong when there's capable actors involved.
And I'm actually going to forget what I have on my notes and just say the same really applies to Lily Cole.
You know what? She was passable.
Barely. The scene where she found out about the deal and kind of exploded on him, that was just painfully bad.
Yeah, there were. She had her awkward moments, but Farrell was just, "Hi."
Yeah, well, he's the opposite end, yeah.
It's like, what? How's it going?
Anyway, until next week when we'll be reviewing Waiting for Guffman, go to zombietakeout.com, check out the album art, the episode description, of course the episode itself, which you're already listening to, links to find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, links to subscribe via RSS and iTunes. Please leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. We'd really appreciate it. You also find the movie list, every movie we've reviewed so far, and every movie we're going to review. Next two, counting Guffman, are in order.
The big bus is the placeholder.
Actually, Legend is for now.
I know.
I suspect that's going to be for a while.
I just think it's a great joke to have.
Oh,
Say,
of course.
Big bus is the placeholder, even though we did it, like, what, 20 episodes ago.
You'll also find the request form. If you've got a movie you'd like to hear us review, leave it on the request form. We'll get to it eventually. And the recommendations list. I just couldn't do it.
Oh, wow.
It was just a little shy. You can also email us, zombietakeout@gmail.com, or leave us a voicemail at 414-368-ZTO1, or for the alphanumerically challenged, 414-368-9861. Of course, always remember that you'll be calling from the middle of Milwaukee.
The middle of Milwaukee.
And until next week, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.
Hold your tongue, you smug little pestle!
And of course, I mean, I won't reenact it or anything, but as soon as you hear it,
we thought about that for the intro.
Yeah, we tried it. Holy shit. But
anyway,
I mean, hey, what about high tech visual or high tech audio effects we used for that intro, by the way? Just saying.
I should have just recorded it straight and pitched it up. Anyway.